time for the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Welcome, everyone. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. Coming up in the show here today, I'll have national and regional agricultural news headlines. The show kicks off with regional agricultural news right after this.
Unsure of your navel orange worm program? No worries now with Rango, a proven solution to protect your orchard at hull split from navel orange worm. Rango is an OMRI-listed, broad-spectrum biopesticide with no known resistance, making it an excellent rotation and tank mix partner for both conventional and organic growers. Partner with Rango today. Contact your PCA, local dealer, or visit rangonow.com. Rango, no worries now.
In regional agricultural news, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service California Crop Progress and Condition Report, average lows for California ranged from 29 to 56 degrees in the mountains last week, 44 to 64 along the coast, 48 to 67 in the Central Valley, and 49 to 80 in the desert. Average highs for the state range from 53 to 85 in the mountains, 60 to 101 along the coast, 73 to 99 in the Central Valley, and 79 to 111 degrees in the desert. In the fruit crops, early varieties of peaches, plums, nectarines, and apricots were harvested. Irrigation and weed control efforts continued. Reflective sheeting was placed to improve stone fruit coloring. Cherry harvest was wrapped up for the season. Grape size continued to increase and vines were trimmed and tied where necessary. Persimmon trees, pomegranate, and kiwi fruit development continued. Various citrus groves continue to be hedgerowed. Golden nugget mandarins, Valencia oranges, tangelos, grapefruit, and lemon harvest progressed. Olive orchards were cleaned and pruned, and blueberry harvest continued. As for nut crops, extreme temperatures have caused damage to nut orchards. Weed control continued where necessary. Insecticide was sprayed where mites were found. Almond hull split began in certain areas of the state. Navel orange worm eggs were found when inspecting hull split in various counties. Walnuts were heavily affected by strong winds, and pistachios were changing color as of the end of last week. In the vegetable crops, growers prepared for the upcoming cherry tomato harvest in the Capay Valley. In Stanislaus County, sweet potato transplants winded down. In Tulare County, summer vegetable crop plantings continued and have developed well with the warmer weather. Squash was harvested while peppers continued to develop. Melon fields were weeded in preparation for harvest. Also from USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in the Pacific Region Milk Production Report, milk production during May totaled 3.66 billion pounds. That's down 1.7% from May of 2021 and up 1.2% from April of 2022. The number of cows on farms in California was 1.72 million head, up 3,000 from May of 2021 and unchanged from April of 2022. Production per cow in California averaged 2,125 pounds, down 40 pounds from May of 2021 and up 25 pounds from April of 2022. Agriculture and business groups are imploring Governor Gavin Newsom and the legislature to set clear goals for boosting water storage and supplies as the drought threatens to cripple California's food, energy, and housing sectors. The existing water system can no longer deliver the water necessary to sustain the world's fifth largest economy, according to the California Farm Bureau and nearly two dozen farm business groups in a letter written on June 14th to the state's executive and legislative branches. California must establish a clear target to increase its surface water supply to meet current and future needs for human consumption and a growing economy, according to the letter. Danny Merkley, Farm Bureau's Director of Water Resources, said Farm Bureau signed the letter because it is time to sound the alarm. It's been 7.5 years since the voters of California overwhelmingly passed Proposition 1 with $2.7 billion for the public benefit portion of new water storage, and yet not $1 has yet been spent on a construction of new storage, according to Merkley. If Newsom is sincere about California's water resilience, he will work with the legislature to get funding out the door right now to upgrade the aging water infrastructure for today's 21st century water realities. The coalition contended that the state's current strategy is to reduce supplies and ask people to do more with less. As a result, the letter says, they are merely managing economic decline. The letter cited a 2021 study from the University of California, Merced, that found 385,000 acres of farmland were fallowed last year on account of lack of water. That led to a $1.1 billion loss to farmers and a loss of 8,750 agricultural jobs. Overall, agriculture and related sectors lost $1.7 billion and more than 14,600 full and part-time jobs, according to the report. The letter also cited a 2020 study from UC Berkeley that examined the effects of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act on farmers and ranchers. That report concluded that as many as 1 million acres of San Joaquin Valley farmland may be fallowed over 2 to 3 decades because of restrictions on surface water supplies and groundwater pumping. The coalition letter noted that in light of the economic peril presented by groundwater regulations, the State Department of Water Resources has allocated $100 million to help groundwater sustainability agencies implement projects that comply with the law and assist affected communities. And the letter says, we need more, significantly more investment in this area to ensure communities can adequately transition. The governor's May revision to his budget proposal recommended $2 billion for water funding, but only $500 million over several years for storage. The Senate's budget proposal calls for $7.5 billion over 3 years, but the letter noted that $2.5 billion of this is directed towards environmental uses, not by making new water available. Other signatories of the letter included the Valley Ag Water Coalition, Western Growers, Agricultural Council of California, the California League of Food Producers, the California Business Roundtable, and a California Manufacturers and Technology Association. California is gearing up to begin harvesting its fresh crop sweet potatoes next month. In the meantime, sweet potato supplies and availability are tighter across the marketplace, according to Prescott Leba, Director of Sales for Baco Sweet, based in Bakersfield. Sweet potato storage will continue to be used for the next 2 months. Supplies get tight during this time of the year unless you have a bumper crop across the category. Sweet potato demand, though, tends to slow down this time of the year. It's when people are looking for summer items like stone fruit and berries, according to Leba. He says they are seeing stronger demand during the summer than they've ever had before as sweet potatoes gain popularity as a summer item. Alexandra Ray Mullenby, Director of Marketing for Baco Sweet, adds that sweet potatoes have become more popular in the U.S. in recent years, with consumption increasing 50% since 2000, from 4.2 to 6.3 pounds per capita.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit Phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
Using drip irrigation on sweet corn is a relatively new concept, especially in the Imperial Valley desert region. Most of the fields are still irrigated using furrow irrigation. UC Irrigation and Water Management Advisor Ali Montazar hopes to change that by providing science-based information for growers who want to switch. During field trials conducted during the 2021-22 season, he found substantial water and fertilizer savings using drip without seeing the concerns growers had about salinity. He also saw a slight increase in marketable yield with drip. Montazar was quick to point out that soil moisture sensors complemented the drip irrigation, and it really was the two together that produced the results. This season, he plans to continue the trials to fine-tune irrigation and fertilizer applications. He also hopes to conduct an economic analysis.
The low desert has very unique environment, diverse cropping systems, soil types, and conditions. Is different from the other region in California, including Central Valley. And drip also is relatively new to both sweet corn and field corn in this region. Well, under these circumstances, to adapt a new technology like drip for a new commodity, or growers need information specifically to see how viable the technology is and what are promises and pitfalls. Actually, this is what we did. There are concerns specifically about salinity and economic feasibility, you know, of this technology in the desert. Or growers mostly use a portable pump, not reservoir or fixed pump station like Central Valley. Sometimes diverse crop rotation, we have a very diverse crop rotation, is a challenge. and force growers to use drip tape only for one season in one field, and they cannot use it, you know, for the second year. And besides that, there were not conducted many irrigation studies in the low desert and even in California in sweet corn. I'm hoping, you know, this study develops some practical and useful information for using drip and best irrigation management of sweet corn in the desert.
During the 2021-22 season, 6 fields were irrigated using drip and 5 were furrow irrigated. Montazar worked with cooperating growers who would furrow irrigate their fields as usual. In the drip fields, the drip tape was buried about 1.5 inches below the soil surface, since sweet corn is a shallow-rooted crop. 2 or 3 soil moisture sensors in each field guided the irrigation scheduling.
Thanks to our progressive growers, you know, I'm always enjoying to work with progressive growers. We are, you know, we work together very much here in the desert. So in this study, I had a chance to work with 14 commercial fields over 2 years in Imperial Valley. 6 of these fields were under furrow irrigation, which dominates irrigation system in sweet corn, and 8 fields were under shallow depth drip irrigation. In each field, we had 2-3 soil moisture monitoring stations in multiple depth, from 6 to 48 inches depth. We monitor applied water and fertilizer the entire season for all these fields, and at the end of season, also marketable yield in each field. To develop a crop coefficient and crop water use model, we took images on a weekly basis using an infrared camera as well. We basically worked with 3 fields in the first year and 11 fields, commercial fields, in the second year, and all trials were under grower practice.
Montazar said he didn't interfere with grower irrigation practices during the season because he wanted the results to reflect real-world practices. Afterward, he shared the results with the cooperators.
Even though we had a lot of soil moisture sensors and ET sensors or evapotranspiration sensors and were able to recommend proper irrigation scheduling, but I didn't interfere grower irrigation decision to make sure our findings represent real grower practice. This is very important, you know, to show, because when we talk about, you know, water conservation, we want to learn from growers and real practice. Those growers ask me sometimes about, you know, their irrigation management. I just provided some comments, how you do, or, you know, if you want to do changes, you know, go this way. But I left making decision for irrigation scheduling to them. I shared the result, you know, at the end of season with them, not in the middle of season to interfere their decision. Also need to be noted that the cooperative farms use soil moisture sensors themselves in the drip irrigated fields, but they didn't use it in furrow irrigated fields. It means, in other words, we should give credits to both drip irrigation system and soil moisture sensing for the improvements I reported in this study.
Montazar found an average water savings of 2.2 acre feet per acre in the drip fields compared to the furrow irrigated fields. That's about 37% less water used in the drip fields. He had previously conducted drip studies on other Imperial Valley crops, and he said this was by far the largest water savings he had seen. But he said you have to keep in mind the area's sandy or sandy loam soils for one reason for the differences. The drip allowed growers to keep the root zone at the optimum moisture levels by applying small amounts of water more frequently than furrow irrigation. A well-designed drip system also allowed them to irrigate the field uniformly.
Even, you know, when I found this, because I sit down, you know, sat down with the growers, and I said, oh, I'm surprised, actually impressed, not surprised, you know. Over the last 5 years, to make it clear what's going on, I did several studies to assess the viability of drip in different commodities, for sugar beet, onions, lettuce, alfalfa, wheat, and recently sweet corn. So I have never seen this high water conservation in any of those in the past. For the 11 sweet corn fields where we work recently, we observed an average of 2.2 acre feet per acre water saving, which is the highest, as I mentioned, I have ever seen in the desert. But we need to keep in mind things here. The soil texture of all these fields were sandy loam to loamy fine sand, which means all fields, they had a very light soil. I think this is the main point we need to keep in mind. Soil types need to be under consideration here. If you have a large scale sweet corn field like what we have in the desert, and your soil is light soil type, and the field is under thorough irrigation, you might need to apply a lot of water to maintain soil moisture distribution uniformity over the crop season. When you convert it to drip, you basically use the main advantage of drip system, which is maintaining soil moisture distribution uniformity in a desired level over time and space. I think this is what really happened in this sandy soil. And then you are able to schedule irrigation more frequently with very light irrigation events. I think we have this high water saving amount, firstly, because of the potential of drip system for water saving in sandy soil, and secondly, integrating drip and soil moisture sensing. I think those variables need to be taken under consideration here.
As part of these trials, Montazar also looked at fertilizer use. He found an average savings of more than $145 per acre on the drip fields compared to the fur irrigated fields. That's about 26% less fertilizer cost in the drip irrigated fields compared to the grower standard practice. And marketable yields were about 5% greater in the drip fields.
As I mentioned, we tracked the amount of fertilizer applied in each of those fields, and then we calculated, and I did a calculation with growers with the real number of this year to calculate the total expense of applied fertilizer in all those fields. This is the result we got for this year. Our data shows the total expense of applied fertilizer in the drip irrigated field were $146 per acre less on average than furrow irrigated fields, which is huge impact, nearly 26% less fertilizer cost in drip irrigated fields.
This is Vicki Boyd reporting for My Ag Life.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
In national agricultural news, new data released this week from USDA's Economic Research Service shows the number of U.S. farms continues to decline slowly. After peaking at 6.8 million farms in 1935, the number of U.S. farms and ranches fell sharply through the early 1970s. Rapidly falling farm numbers in the mid-20th century reflected the growing productivity of agriculture and increased non-farm employment opportunities. Since then, the number of U.S. farms has continued to decline, but much more slowly. In 2021, there were 2.01 million U.S. farms, down from 2.20 million in 2007. With 895 million acres of farmland nationwide in 2021, the average farm size was 445 acres, only slightly greater than the 440 acres recorded in the early 1970s. Meanwhile, technological developments in agriculture have influenced changes in the farm sector. Innovations have enabled continuing output growth without adding much to inputs. As a result, total farm output nearly tripled between 1948 and 2019. Rural bankers say they anticipate a U.S. recession, according to the latest Creighton University Rural Main Street Index. The region's overall reading for June slumped to 49.8, its lowest level since September of 2020, and down from May's 57.7. The index ranges between 0 and 100, with a reading of 50 representing growth neutral. Approximately 92.9% of rural bankers surveyed rate the likelihood of a U.S. recession above 50%. Only 7.1% rated a recession probability below 50%. In with the latest on rice heading and rice conditions, it's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey with a report.
Looking at rice, our first look at heading progress for the week ending June 19th, showing 5% of the crop headed. That's equal to the 5-year average ahead of last year's 3%. Almost all of the crop that is heading is that earlier planted crop in the Western Gulf Coast region. It's been hot and dry there, so we'll have to watch for any impacts on the crop as it heads out in that region. despite the hot, dry weather in many of the rice production areas, the crop still looks pretty good, rated 72% good to excellent, just 1% very poor to poor on June 19th. Very little change from last week's numbers, and also pretty close to what we saw this time a year ago.
Once again, USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey. Agriculture groups have expressed disappointment regarding a Supreme Court decision denying consideration of the case of Monsanto versus Hedeman, which pertains to state glyphosate health warnings. A coalition of groups issued a joint statement regarding the decision this week, including the American Farm Bureau Federation. The letter says they are disappointed that the Supreme Court has decided not to hear this case, which has significant implications for the global food supply and science-based regulation. On May 23rd, the group sent a letter signed by 54 agricultural groups to President Joe Biden, urging him to withdraw a Solicitor General's brief submitted to the Supreme Court, advising against taking up the case. The Solicitor General's brief argues federal pesticide registration and labeling requirements do not preclude states from imposing additional labeling requirements, even if those requirements run counter to federal findings. U.S. Department of Agriculture Deputy Secretary Dr. Jewel Brona arrived earlier this week in London and is launching a USDA agribusiness trade mission to the United Kingdom. Brona is joined by a delegation of representatives from U.S. agribusinesses, farm organizations, and state departments of agriculture who are interested in exploring export opportunities in the United Kingdom. Brona says the United Kingdom is a valued trading partner whose consumers demand the best quality products at a competitive price, adding that she's excited for mission participants to engage with potential customers for their world-class agricultural products. In 2021, the United Kingdom imported $1.9 billion of U.S. agricultural products, according to USDA. Trade mission participants engage directly with potential customers, receive in-depth market briefings, and participate in site visits. The USDA-sponsored trade mission to the United Kingdom is one of four international trade missions that USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack announced back in March. The Department of Agriculture has announced $80 million in awards under the Dairy Business Innovation Initiatives. The awards support processing capacity expansion, on-farm improvements, and technical assistance services to producers. The funds are being awarded non-competitively to the four current Dairy Business Innovation Initiatives at the California State University Fresno, the University of Tennessee, Vermont Agency of Agriculture, Food and Markets, and the University of Wisconsin. Additionally, USDA announced $22.9 million through a request for applications for funding provided by fiscal year 2022 appropriations to support the same initiatives. The awards were made possible by supplemental funds from the American Rescue Plan Act. Jenny Lester Moffitt, USDA Undersecretary for Marketing and Regulatory Programs, says the Dairy Business Innovation Initiatives have proven to be an invaluable resource for dairy farmers and businesses because of their ability to provide targeted resources and funding through sub-awards at the local and regional level, maximizing impact.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission. Delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
The Certified Crop Advisor of the Year Award recognizes a Western Region Certified Crop Advisor who has shown dedicated and exceptional performance as an agronomist and leads others to promote agricultural practices that benefit the farmers and environment in the Western Region. During the upcoming Crop Consultant Conference this year in September, the winner of this year's CCA of the Year Award will be presented.
Western Region Certified Crop Advisor of the Year Award recognizes the best of the best from our membership, and that membership covers California, Arizona, and Hawaii. So we've got a large pool of folks to choose from, around 1,400 total certified crop advisors and certified professional agronomists that we can recognize. And really what we look for is the crop advisor that is the top 1%, the one that's really setting the standard for their region and providing that quality crop advising experience and information.
That was Dr. Carl Wyant, chair on Western Region CCA's board, and he said the competition for the CCA of the Year Award is heating up as the award gets more popular each year.
Every year, it's such a competition. You know, we keep growing this award year over year, and you know we're looking to recognize that Western Region Certified Crop Advisor, member that shows dedicated and exceptional performance as an agronomist and also leads their area to promote agricultural practices that benefits the grower and benefits the environment. So it's a pretty big stage to get on and some big shoes to fill when you look at past award winners. And so the board has really set forth some, you know, guidelines, and they're on the Western Region Certified Crop Advisor website that really outlines what we're looking for. And it really revolves around, you know, how long have you been in this crop advising space? And so we, you know, how long have you had that CCA license or that CPAG license? We look at the scope of your crop advising work. You know, what is your influence on your local agricultural industry from a crop advising standpoint? And then we looked at for unique skills, the things that set you apart. You know, this could be nutrient plans, salinity and water management plans, the use of precision ag tools, drones, that sort of thing. And so we look for these applications that are very complete from an influence standpoint, from a technical skills standpoint, and then from a, you know, from this broader context of community involvement. You know, how involved are you with the CCA program? You know, giving talks, giving you know, webinars, writing articles in the ag media to help promote sound crop advising. And then lastly, we look for your community involvement. You know, being a certified crop advisor or a certified professional agronomist, it's a leadership position. It's a position that for folks that love to educate and love to help others. So that we look for that community involvement, and we want to make sure that you you know, really are doing your part and volunteering and staying connected, you know, with your local agricultural community.
Nominees will be evaluated on a rubric that includes certified crop advising experience, the scope of crop advising work, unique skills, CCA program involvement, and community involvement and volunteer service.
We have a whole rubric to help us figure out across these broad categories, from that community involvement to the technical skills to the crop advising skills and so forth, so we can actually standardize the grading of each candidate. And every year it's tough, and there's always a close call, and we're fortunate to have really, really strong membership that excel. And unfortunately, we can only recognize one CCA of the year, but we get the job done. And of course, it's always a really powerful impact on our membership to get this award.
Applying for the award is easy. Wyatt said on the application, there must be a nominator, a nominee, and a reference.
You go to wrcca.org, click on awards at the top, and then you'll see the CCA of the year application. And it shows all the text boxes you need to fill in and submit. It shows you the full application rubric, so you can see exactly what information you need to include. It'll take about 5 to 10 minutes. Applications are due on the last Friday of July, which this year would make it July 29th. So we can sort through the applications, assign all the different scores to the applicants, and then make our award at the September Progressive Crop Consultant Conference in Visalia.
The Crop Consultant Conference in Visalia, where the award will be presented, will take place on September 28th and 29th. To register, go to progressivecropconsultant.com. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Chalstrom.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing team, thank you for listening.